Hello and welcome to Grow Global. I am your host, Patricia Demetrio. Welcome to podcast number 8. We are going to be speaking a lot on social emotional learning. Grow Global is sponsored by Platinum Credit Group. They help individuals and organizations with financial education to help them with startup loans and or working capital. They provide in-depth credit, income, and financial background reviews before submitting applications to lenders on business owners' behalf. We are truly grateful to Platinum Credit Group for helping to fund this podcast, which in part helps to make this show possible. Hello and welcome to Grow Global. I'm your host, Patricia Demetrio. Today we will be speaking with Dr. Diana Maiello. And the episode is going to be about adults and the effect that they have on the development of youth with social emotional learning and what can help children feel seen, heard, and safe. Thank you so much, Dr. Maiello, for, did I say it right?
Yes.
Okay, for being with me today.
You're welcome.
Yes, out of all the topics we had, this is one of my favorites because, you know, our whole organization is based essentially around life skills and global education. And that component around life skills is so important. And I'm so happy to have you, an expert in, you know, what you teach or talk about and all the things that you've learned in your life to speak about this, because I think a lot of times it's something that is not looked at enough, because usually kids are learning these things at home. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they may not be learning it at home, and it could be a real problem when you're putting a school setting environment and, you know, we rely on these social skills. My first question is, how do children essentially learn these different social skills?
Okay, well, thank you so much for having me. I can talk about social emotional learning all day. I think, like you just shared, it's one of my favorite topics. As someone who's a psychologist and a therapist who's really grounded in attachment theory, I would say this is the foundation of really who we are. Our ability to learn social skills happens in relationships. So really it happens day one, you know, when we're born and out of the womb, we're learning in the context of relationships. We learn about ourselves, we learn about other people in the world, how people show up for us, what to expect about the world and other people in it, and how to be human, really. There's no manual. We learn by watching other people be human.
Yeah, and if people aren't showing up to in a way that you're able to learn, or there's some dysfunction from the people that are parenting a child, what I guess by default they would not learn essential skills, perhaps. Would that be, you know, correct to say?
So maybe the execution of social skills, and I think it depends what kinds of social skills we're really talking about, but, you know, it's amazing. In talking to people who have had deficits in that area, where maybe their parents couldn't show up for them in the best way possible, I think, you know, attachment is like this evolutionarily built-in need, right? We have this need for connection, and it amazes me every day almost that people know what they need even if they didn't have it. It's like we have that craving for connection and empathy and to be seen and to have, you know, other people see us, understand us, feel us, get us. And that hopefully is done by caregivers, but sometimes it's not. And yet people still have this craving, like it's out there. I need it. I know what it kind of should look like, and I'm going to keep trying for it. And they do. People keep trying.
Yeah. And so just a side note from my questions, though, because I was looking at a documentary about, I'm sure you've heard, people like psychopaths, people like, for example, Jeffrey Dahmer, who he wasn't able to, he lacked social skills. He lacked a lot of things that he needed. And I think that's how he deviated to his dark side. How does a child like that become that way if the parents say, well, we were a normal family, you know, there was nothing really dysfunctional? Like, what is that yeah. happens to them?
So that's kind of the question I get every semester, day one in intro psych, like, what about serial killers? What happens there? And it's so fascinating and interesting. And I'm not an expert in serial killers or people who have, you know, really tremendous deficits.
That's the extreme, right?
That is the extreme. Oh, yeah. I can point people in a direction that might explain better. So there's a phenomenal psychiatrist named Bruce Perry, who has dealt with families and children who've experienced severe trauma. So maybe your listeners or you have heard of the ACEs study, adverse childhood experiences, yes. and all of the really severe things that kids could go through that are actually somewhat common, unfortunately, too. But on the really severe, intense end of that, you know, there's this saying that, you know, the brain neurons that fire together wire together, right? And so when babies get that stimulation, get input from the outside, like attention and holding and affection and trust, like trust that there's someone else in the world, mm-hmm. then those neurons fire and mm-hmm. connect through experience, right? Mm-hmm. Our brain architecture has to connect through some input, some experience.
Okay. Right.
So, you know, it's hard to tell. And this is like the question of psychology in general. How much is nature? How much is nurture? How much is interactive? Mm-hmm. There could be, you know, parents who are sort of doing everything they're supposed to do and yet still have a child who has some severe, you know, behavioral disruptions. Mm-hmm. But at some point there's likely, I mean, when you hear stories about people who've done sort of heinous crimes, more often than not, they have experienced a lack of, a deprivation of those positive inputs that would wire the brain in such a way where there's connection to people, emotional connection, empathy, mm-hmm. right? And so that yeah. is just, it's like the absence of connection.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Wow. It's just so important. So important.
Yeah.
My next question is, I guess it really answers your question. They learn this behavior, you know, when they are born. And if they are lacking it, then that could be a trigger to dysfunction later in life, essentially. So how can parents who may be concerned, like, you know, teach their children social skills to their children, or is it something they should, you know, consciously think about? Or is it something that, like, for a lot of things that you really need to teach, like, you know, showing responsibility, you can show that. And sometimes kids may not be learning that. So, you know, how can parents make sure that they are teaching their children important social skills?
Mm-hmm. Such a great question and a big question. So I guess the number one thing I would say right off the bat is that parents do their best with the resources they have available. I think we all, for the most part, have really good intentions. We want to do the best we can in teaching our kids, you know, how to be good humans. The way that we mostly learn in the world is by watching. So, you know, one of the first things that we could do is make sure as humans, we have as much of as our own stuff together as possible. There's another great psychiatrist named Dan Siegel, and he writes a book, Parenting from the Inside Out, which is part neuroscience and part workbook, where basically, it's helping parents stay on top of their own triggers, right? So I think one of the best lessons we could provide is emotion regulation and controlling our own emotions. And it's really hard. It's easy to talk about all day. You can talk about it, but really putting it into practice is hard, because when your emotions get triggered, your brain goes right to that, you know, middle place, that limbic system with big sort of a big response. But the more that we can sort of stay calm in that calm, cool, collected place, we're modeling that for our children. And also one of the big things that I think parents can do is not worrying about, and again, as a parent, this is hard to do in the moment, but not worrying so much about what our response should be. You know, I think as well-intentioned parents, we want to do the right thing. We don't always know what the right thing is. So coming from a place instead of curiosity. So when our child does something, maybe they, you know, are upset and they throw something across the room, or they say, shut up, to their brother. Instead of really coming in with a response that you're maybe not sure of how to give in the moment, coming in with curiosity first and foremost, you know, what did that response mean? What did that behavior mean for that child? Like understanding, if we could take a moment at what's that inner child's world like in this moment, right? What are they doing or not doing? And sometimes, you know, in our traditional ideas about discipline and punishment, discipline or a lot of parents who, you know, do more punishment or consequences for negative behavior or behavior they don't want, punishment's really teaching the child what not to do, but not what to do.
That's a good point. That's right? A really good point. Yeah, yeah. Okay, I'm guilty of that.
Oh, we all are. Yeah, we all are. Because, you know, those behaviors like throwing something across the room or telling your brother to shut up, those are disruptive. Those are big behaviors that we want to squash right away and stop. But we're not really showing them often, unless we're modeling it, or highlighting or giving them some ideas what they can do instead. So for example, if we meet them where they are and have curiosity and understand why they're having a hard time in the moment, you know, it could be something as simple for a toddler meltdown, like he took my toy, or I don't want to get dressed right now. Well, that is a good reason. It's understandable. Adults don't always want to get dressed and, you know, go to work or school. So joining with the child in that moment, and just even something as simple as like, I get it, I understand.
That reinforcement, I'm hearing.
And also validation, right? Validation of emotions. Like, you're allowed to not be happy right now that we're getting dressed and you have to stop playing. I get it. I wouldn't want to do that either.
Yeah. I just think of when my daughter had a big meltdown one time. It was off the chart meltdown. Yeah. I don't know if I could have reasoned with her at that moment, but or validated with her, you know, okay, I understand.
It's so hard. It's so hard in the moment. And we are not perfect. We are not, and we're not supposed to be perfect. Right. We're really not, because the world isn't perfect.
Right. So we have to do our best. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. But these are good things to know. I think, you know, being able to validate when a child or, you know, your young teenager just doesn't want to do something, or you want them to and they're just adamant about not doing it. You know, it's a learning process, right? To do the things you don't really want to do. I mean, you kind of have to bend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It is.
Okay, so there are children out there that grew up with compassionate parents, and there are kids that are not afraid of talking with their parents whenever there is a problem. Now, on the other hand, there are kids that grew up with very strict parents. Many times they are afraid of talking to their parents whenever they find themselves having a question or a problem. And I know I'm kind of like that. I can be very strict with my daughter. I'm more strict with her than I was with my son. How can we, turn parents that, like myself, that can be pretty strict into being more compassionate about things that we are a lot more strict about? Or if you can even do that. I mean, I think it's a broad question, but I don't like being seen as really the strict parent, but I just have, requirements. And I feel like it just comes down to being strict. I can't do anything kind of a thing. How is there a way to even turn that around, I guess, is the question.
Yeah. Well, actually, maybe I'll throw it back for a second. Can you give an example of something you feel you're strict about,
yes,
but would like to be more compassionate about?
Well, I am very strict about my daughter when she wants to go do something with friends. And like with my son, he could just tell me who his friends were and I'd let him do it. But with my daughter, I'm less apprehensive to allow her because I can just imagine her. I feel like being kidnapped because she's a girl. She's more vulnerable. I just think that she is more preyed upon than my son would have been. And that gives me the high anxiety. And so she doesn't get as much freedom as my son did when he wanted to go out. Now, they're young teenagers at this point. So that's an example I can think of.
Yeah. So as a parent of a tween myself, I empathize. Someone who's a little older than her years and wants to do all the things, it's hard. And without making this, personal about you, but I hear, you talking about some anxiety that you have piqued. And again, I would encourage all of us as parents to do our own work. So is that a little bit more anxiety on your part, or does it really reflect something about, exactly what your daughter is going to do? So is it, I don't want to say real, because there's always real danger out there, but is it a higher likelihood danger in the things that she wants to do versus your son maybe? Or is it your sort of perception that things can just happen to her? Because I feel like that's creating this idea perhaps for her that the world is a scary place and that she needs to only exist in like a small, portion of it, that she doesn't have access to the whole world.
Yeah.
Because it's scary, but that's a different message that she may see her brother getting, that he has access to more of the world.
Yeah.
And I wonder what secondary things that is perhaps starting to trigger for her about her own power and movement in the world. So if something scary happens, will I be able to handle it? Will I be able to, navigate the world? Or do I inherently not have the skills to do that?
I think she would. I just don't want to find out if she would.
Absolutely. It's totally understandable.
Savvy and smart in a way that she could protect herself, I think, better than my son in terms of it not being a physical thing. Mentally, she's very sharp as a whip. Like, yeah.
Right. So maybe she knows too much.
I think that's what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I it's so hard because on the one hand, we want to protect our children. We don't want them to endure anything that they really don't have to if it causes them pain or hurt. On the other hand, though, we have to prepare them for, easier said than done, the world without us. We have to start giving them those legs and those muscles that we are not going to be there all the time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think about it as like, and I've even told my daughter this, I'm lending you my frontal lobe because they don't have that.
They don't have it developed yet, right?
No, no, they won't until they're in their mid-20s. So let me lend you what's going on inside my brain right now. And maybe I do worry a lot. And here's where the compassion can come in. Mm-hmm. It's the warmth. You know, you're allowed to have your fears. You're allowed to have your anxieties. You're allowed to have your rules, if that's what's comfortable for you. But maybe bringing in a little warmth where you're disclosing to them, it's because I love you more than anything in the world. Mm. You know, and I don't want anything to happen to you. And maybe I go a little bit the other way in trying to protect you. And maybe there's room for negotiation there. You know, maybe, you know, I'm a little too intense on my fears, and maybe you're, you know, pushing for a little too much that I'm comfortable with. But, you know, let's see if we could at least understand each other. Mm-hmm. That my rules are because I love you. The warmth and the compassion, that can come through no matter what you decide your rules are.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's a side that I need to show more of when I'm having these high anxieties. Because, yeah, I think that would help a lot. Yeah.
It's hard when you're scared.
Yeah. And the world is such a scary place, I think, especially for girls. There's so many predators in this world, and it just is scary. It's so even my mom to this day, as a grown woman, she'll call me, you know, and she'll hear a story, lock your doors, make sure, you know, I heard this story, blah, blah, like it's going to happen to me, you know, and I'm grown. Yes. So I just,
our mothers must have been friends then, because
you know, I hear it a lot, though. I hear a lot of parents do that. Yeah,
definitely.
That's something. Okay, so now, do you think that the pandemic has affected our children's social skills abilities? Being at home on the computer a lot, I think maybe that could have affected it. How have you seen that, if you have?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, we decided to keep our children virtual that second year into the pandemic. So they went back last year, but the year before that, they were virtual before the vaccines were out. So anecdotally, and also in practice and in schools, yeah, absolutely. I see the pandemic has affected social skills in a really unique way. And I don't know if adults have done enough catching our kids up as we've sort of returned back to normal. So when you think about it, you know, the pandemic, when it first started, was just fear-based, right? We literally do not know what is safe anymore. We don't know if stores are safe. We don't know if people are safe.
Right.
We are potentially, you know, going to infect ourselves or others with something that really did cause the worst possible outcome. And that's really scary. And our kids saw that. And, you know, a lot of parents talk to their kids about what was going on. And, you know, we don't have answers, but, you know, we're doing our best to keep each other healthy and safe. But as we've kind of gone back to normal, I've actually seen and talked to a lot of people who say anxiety has risen on the return to normalcy.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because how do you, and again, I go back to biology, like our nervous system was now faced with a threat and we were going to shelter and isolate and keep ourselves safe. But your brain doesn't really catch up that quickly that things are now okay again, right? Your nervous system's sole responsibility is to keep us safe. So how do we really feel safe from such really intense, you know, fear of others, really? So yeah, I think kids who, you know, were going through it at the time at different ages, kids who were born into the pandemic, they just have a really distorted sense of what safety and maybe comfort around other people looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it would be safe to say that, yeah. Because we really still don't really have all the answers. I mean, they're talking about getting boosters still. We don't know the effects of a lot of things that, I mean, hasn't been that long ago. So it's just something we're going to have to learn to navigate and to bring children into learning important social skills as best we can. How do you do it with your children if they're virtual? Like, do you make it a point that they have like play dates, or I don't know how old they are, but I'm just seeing like, how do you navigate that?
Well, they were only virtual before really the vaccines came out for children. And they've been back in school for a couple of years now, I guess 18 months or so. But, you know, it was conversations around, we know more now. So we weren't sure when this first started, you know, how to keep ourselves safe. But, you know, we have medicine now that can help boost our body and keep us safe. So giving them really clear parameters of, you know, we wouldn't be doing this, like going back to socializing and having play dates, and if we thought it would be too much of a risk for you, but we're pretty confident now that, you know, we're gonna be okay. And it's just having that like confidence as a parent that you're imparting on them, like, you can take your cue from us. We're confident. We wouldn't put you in a scary situation if we thought the risk was too great, but we're pretty we are confident that, you know, we're gonna, you know, yes, we might get COVID and, you know, we'll take care of ourselves when we're sick, but we're in a much different place than we were when we weren't sure what was going on in the world yet. And so really having confidence, like as parents, I think we have to be the container for kids because their emotions can get big and irrational. Like, don't go to a store, you're gonna die, you know?
Right, yeah.
But we have to contain it for them. Like, I understand your worry, and here's what it is.
Mm-hmm. It's so important for parents to set the example in so many things. And it worries me when children don't have the type of parents that are setting a good example, you know, and I think this is what a lot of times teachers in the classroom have to deal with, the kids that don't get these important social cues and things that they need from their parents. And then the kids come into school and behaving so dysfunctionally. It was like today I was teaching and a teacher came up to me and was, because I was subbing for him, and he was just telling me about how he could tell what kids get from their home. Like, he knew just from how the children, certain kids would behave. Mm-hmm. And it really is so, it starts in the home. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard when you have kids that don't have those parents that can give these really important social cues and can really set the example, like what you're saying, you know?
Yeah.
And it's something that's why we're here. That's why, you know, we do what we do, so that when we have supplemental educational programs for kids that lack a lot of important social skills, they can learn these things here with Life Smart Education. And that's what gives me the hope that, you know, at least we're trying to do what we can around those important social skills. So, wow, it's really, really interesting and good stuff. Okay, so going on, there are children out there that feel rejected by society. Mm-hmm. And before the pandemic, you just need to go to a cafeteria and you would find at least one child maybe eating alone. We believe that kids and teens that find themselves in that situation have a lot to bring to the table when it comes to making new friends. However, some people, this is considered a taboo. You know, sometimes people do not want to address a topic like this. And how can shy kids become more social, or the kid that everyone looks at as being kind of strange or weird? You know, how can, what is the right way to help a child like that? What is something that children that can maybe, that notice maybe a child that is isolated, or there's something wrong with a child that is not integrating into the school society? You know, mm-hmm. is there something like kids are that they could maybe do, or do should you notice that, say something, or just kind of let that kid just be?
That's a great question. So what do you do, right? What do you do when you see a child sitting by themselves or sort of not integrating? And it may be more than, it may be a big answer or it may be a simple answer. You know, it's hard to know on the surface. The simple answer is, I think everybody wants to feel like they belong. Right. So some school districts have, you know, buddy programs, peer programs. Some schools have round lunch tables, so nobody sits really alone, or a buddy bench in the schoolyard. So if someone feels alone, they might go sit on the buddy bench, and that's kind of a cue that they would like to talk to someone, mm-hmm. And someone could go sit next to them. But asking for that help, I mean, I think it's a huge burden on kids who may be feeling rejected and isolated, yeah. to also then have to ask for what they need. I mean, adults don't even know how to identify right. or ask what they need, right?
Yeah.
So it's up to us. I think it's up to adults to find out, you know, let them tell us that they need or prefer alone time. And some kids do. You know, some kids, that's just their temperament, where they might prefer to be alone or one-on-one or need downtime. Mm-hmm. I think as teachers and parents, of course, you know their kid or get to know their kid, you get a sense of maybe, you know, too much people time requires some downtime. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not every kid wants to socialize in the same way, and that's totally okay. But is there something else going on that's causing that behavior, right? And that's hard to know unless mm-hmm. you start, you know, asking and spending time. So the curiosity mm-hmm. that we could bring to a child either as an adult or sort of set up systematically as a peer program, maybe.
Mm-hmm. I like that idea, peer program, because I think about the kids, and this was back in 2001, like the kids with the Columbine, like I know they had problems socially. They were looked at as outcasts. People saw them as weird. And I have seen more compassion from kids in school around kids that seem different. Like my daughter, she's befriended a kid that's a handicapped kid because they don't no longer in their own special classrooms, like they're more integrated with kids. And I can, like when I was younger, kids would have made fun of anyone that was different. I've seen kids be more compassionate today, but I don't think it was always like that. That's why kids like that, Dylan and the other kid from Columbine, did what they did, because they were the prime examples of kids that were bullied. They were made fun of. They didn't fit in. And had only someone knew to check the signs of things that they may be doing in their personal time, you know, or talk to them, right? Absolutely. Because, I mean, who's to say it won't happen again? I mean, I pray that it doesn't, but there are things that we can do, right?
Sure. It has.
I love that idea of buddy program. Like, are these things that schools have contacted you to implement, or do you find that do you get questions or people contacting you about things like this for schools?
So I do more sort of individual therapy okay. or family therapy okay. aside from teaching. So I don't really have the connections doing work with districts mm-hmm. on a widespread level, yeah. but you know, I'm sort of in the trauma world, yeah, peripherally.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's another great saying, not great, but important saying, hurt people hurt people. You know, so when you're hurting, it maybe not always intentionally, but it does come out sometimes. It comes out either toward oneself or other people. So going back to the conversation we had before about, you know, kids who do hurt or adults who do hurt others, often there's some reason,
mm-hmm.
you know, why they're taking that aggression out on other people.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it brings me to the data around that. Is there data about social skills that have been researched to show, like, 'cause I know some of the data we have, like even on our website, about children who have exposure to certain things, they're more likely to XYZ. And is that something that you would have research on that maybe you could even share with us maybe later that we can have? Because we're always trying to improve on the things that we want to offer and seeing how we can help children.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I can definitely provide you with some sources. And again, in that more positive, like what works, vein instead of how bad things are.
Right.
There's another person, a psychologist, Robert Brooks, who writes a lot about building relationships and empathy.
Yes.
In children. And one of the things that shows up for him in his work is mentoring relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't have to be a formal type mentoring relationship. It has to be someone where the child feels seen. So I think I've seen him speak. He came to our school to give a lecture, and he gave this anecdote of a family friend, a neighbor, driving this child to therapy. And it was an hour drive. And, you know, they would chat along the way in the car, and then the kid would get to therapy. And while the therapy was somewhat helpful, even more meaningful to the child was that 1 hour ride where they were in the car with the neighbor, just talking off the cuff. And that sense of, like, I can be myself and someone sees me and understands me and gets me.
Yes.
Sometimes it's a bus driver who gives, you know, a special handshake or something. So it can come from anywhere. It can be an older sibling, but, you know, the child feeling seen, and in therapy we use this principle a lot, or this basic idea that healing starts to happen when people feel seen and heard and understood. Yeah. So I spend a lot of time just validating mm-hmm. for clients or for my students or and especially my own kids, like, I get that. I get why you feel like that. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, a lot of validating and really listening.
Wow, that is so important. It goes a long way, a long way for young kids. What would you like to share with our listeners? Is there any special message or anything you would like to share?
Oh, yes. Well, actually, just piggybacking on what I just said, deep listening is one of the most important things we can gift our children. Just undivided time where we're in their world. We want to soak in their essence and their, you know, inner questions and really, you know, where they are.
Yeah.
The other thing I think that's really important is in attachment work, this concept of rupture and repair. That in all relationships, we're not going to be perfect. We're not going to do the right thing. We're going to fly off the handle. We're going to get upset. Mm-hmm. And rupture is to be expected. But the more important thing is how we come back together and repair. And as adults, we can do this for our kids too. Like, I'm really sorry. I got really upset before. Now that I'm calm and I'm thinking about it, you know, here's what I wish I would have said. And modeling that, but also, you know, showing our kids that we're really in tune with them and we want to make it better, that connection better, is again something we can gift our kids.
That's beautiful. Absolutely. And that reminds me, I have time that I've set aside to be with my daughter today, and we're going to just do some things today. Have to always keep that on the fore, right? Gotta make time for these things, especially when they become teenagers.
Even more important, I think, as teenagers. Yes. Absolutely.
Oh, important. Yes. Okay, well, Dr. Melillo, I want to thank you so much for being with me today. It was a pleasure speaking with you. Is there a book or anything that, or your social media that you would like to have us put out there for you?
I don't have a book out yet, maybe in the future. I have a little Facebook page, but I don't.
Yeah, okay, we'll make sure to put that out there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure talking to you.
You have reinvigorated something in me.
Aww. When it comes
to just trying to be just more compassionate and not be so strict and like, gotta get this done, and just showing love through compassion and sharing love. My anxieties. And oh, it's such a hard thing to navigate as a parent. But man, hearing you and learning these things is so important. This is why I do what I do. Education is the key. It is the key to our world becoming a better place.
I believe that.
Willing to learn and improve, and these things are so important. So thank you for your schooling, everything that you've learned, and passing it on to me.
Oh, thank you for the work that you do and putting this into the world.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you for joining me. Wow, really a truly inspiring and motivational segment we have done today. I'm so excited to be a part of this podcast and to continue the development and education of our young people as well as the adults who support these children. We want to hear from you. So if you have anything that you would like to talk to us about that you heard in this episode today, please reach out to us at info@lifesmarteducation.org and let us know your thoughts. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Life Smart Education. Today's show was produced by Keith Richardson, edited and written by our social media producer, JD Johnson. Thanks to our friends from Platinum Credit Group and our friends at WCBE 90.5 FM for sponsoring this podcast and making it happen. I'm your host, Patricia Demetrio. This is Grow Global. Thanks for listening.
On Jazz Sunday, we hand curate the classics for you, and we treat your ears to the mesmerizing music of rising young stars such as Jasmiya Horn, Emmett Cohen, Lakeisha Benjamin, and Christian Sands. The best of the past and present and the future found. Hear it all on Jazz Sunday from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. exclusively on WCBE.
I know when you hear podcast, you may think, I'm not great with technology. I don't want to have one more thing to worry about. But I'm here to tell you, you're missing out on so many amazing stories. And WCBE has made it easier than ever to listen to their own curated list of locally produced podcasts. Just go to WCBE.org and click the podcast experience. You don't have to learn how to use any new technology. Just click on the podcast you want to hear and click play. And don't forget to listen to my show, The Internet Says It's True with Michael Kent.